This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the best thing that you can say this week is the markets were finally up. We saw some wide divergences this week. We had oil prices touching down well below $30 a barrel, actually down to 26 before marching right back up over 30. And then we had the stock markets in the recovery mode. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, we got John Kozar from Asbury Research. John's concerned that we've had some important trend lines break that have been in place in 2009. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. Dave Morgan will be joining me on precious metals. He thinks we're at an inflection point. He'll be here to tell you why. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about the market moving events of this week. And there have been plenty of them.
And I'm John Loeffler, and there have been indeed plenty of events in the market this week. As a matter of fact, since the first of the year, why is all of that? Well, there are various factors injecting uncertainty into the market. And one of those factors is the Federal Reserve and its new proposal or threat, which way should we call it, to raise interest rates again, having done so already toward the end of last year. Are they going to do it again? That's part of the ongoing uncertainty, and that's why we can expect the markets to be turbulent for quite some time to come. That's the first part of the big picture. Now, what exactly is the status of this? It seems like we're repeating last year's events all over again in that area, Jim. And then, given the fact that we're in this stormy, turbulent sea, how will the riders on the storm invest? Because if you go to cash, you're not getting anything. But what about risk on the other side? Should you be in? Should you be out? Or is there a third alternative? All of that coming up today on The Big Picture. Well, turbulence has been the name of the game since the beginning of the year for the markets. Ryan Poplava, it looks like the ever elusive bounce technicians have been predicting for weeks now has finally arrived. So what sparked the rally, and what, if anything, supporting this move for more than a couple of days? Because it seems like the trend of this month has been to sell the rally.
Yeah, I agree, John. I see this as a tradable bounce, tradable for nimble traders, not investors. I think it's going to be pretty fast and furious, as they say in the movies. But in bear markets, rallies are pretty strong, and they can be, because we're dealing with shorts that cover, longs that come in for a short while, maybe renting the space. But you know, it started off, just speaking about this week, it started off as a technical bounce on Wednesday. There wasn't really any fundamental news in the economics, earnings release, or anything that really caused a psychological shift. The S&P 500 touched the April and October 2014 lows, and that was between, John, 1814 and 1820. And I think once we touched those levels, there was just an immediate response, and the market reversed course intraday on Wednesday. I was, in fact, watching it tick by tick. The market was extended. And, you know, we've actually been saying that for some time. We've been oversold actually since January 4th on many momentum indicators that we follow, but extended, you know, that's another thing. Tom DeMark created a phenomenal tool, his combo tool, an extension tool that really looks at statistically extensions of this nature. And I believe his signals were pointing towards a buy. You know, we still formed a fresh 52-week low on the S&P despite that reversal. We still closed negative on the day on Wednesday. But that bounce was the stuff that, you know, major bottoms are made of. In fact, the very same type of reversal that we got back in August and October. But, you know, the S&P 500 wasn't the only area to bounce. Oil began to bounce later in that day, and that has been just tracked, John, as a proxy for global growth. So we're watching oil to get an idea of what's going to go on with the emerging markets, et cetera. And the high yield bond area also bouncing. The Russell 2000 bouncing, in fact, closed positive on the day. You know, the Russell 2000 is in a bear market. It's off 23% from the highs as of the close on Wednesday. And that's despite the positive day. But, you know, when you have the bulls not only reverse course on a day, but also close positive like they did for the Russell 2000 and, in fact, even for like biotech. I mean, that's the strongest kind of reversal you can have. So the bounce this week started on a technical note, no question about it. But later in the week, there were a couple of catalysts that did help it along, still technicals helping chip away at some resistance levels that were previously supports. But Mario Draghi on Thursday came out with some comments, and obviously the market does respond to central bankers when they talk about stimulus. And he said they may need to adjust policy due to recent market events at their March meeting. And John, here are some of his comments.
We've plenty of instruments, and especially we have the determination and the willingness and the capacity of the governing council to act and deploy these instruments.
So yeah, with that said, the Japanese press also suggested that the Bank of Japan next week meeting could drop some stimulus bombs on the market as well. So, you know, here we want to see the Fed also meeting next week acknowledge essentially the economic weakness we've been seeing in the late 2015 quarter, and especially in manufacturing. I mean, this has just been relentless there. But the second item, and so there was really two catalysts, was the oil and rally again on Friday, even though we essentially heard the media really talking about this storm out on the east. Essentially, we've been hearing about this storm. You know, this isn't new news. This was reported on Wednesday. But just the fact, I think, that you look at the inventory numbers, there was a draw on distillates instead of a build, which was expected. Those are numbers we got on Thursday. So on top of that and the weather, you know, that's helping oil, and oil is helping the market.
Well, you know, psychology drives a lot of things that happen in the economy and in the market. Would you say psychology has changed in this market at all?
Fear and greed, John, very powerful emotions. You know, I think not for investors. I think fear has set in, maybe for traders. And that is merely for the short term. Like I said, most of the trading desks I talk to, the timeline is a few days, maybe a week or 2 weeks. They're renting the space in their long positions, as I would put it. You know, fundamentals haven't changed in the past 72 hours. The dollar is strong and will likely stay strong if central bank policy continues to diverge. We'll get more color on that next week, I'm hoping, from the FOMC. But even Draghi reiterated on Friday, monetary policies will differ for a while, he said. And that doesn't help the S&P 500's earnings, now, you know, estimated at about 120. So you put a 16 multiple on that, that's 1920, John. That's 13 points away from where we closed from Friday. So fundamentally, you know, nothing has really changed there with, you know, just looking at multinational companies, they're being affected by translation and a strong dollar. And that's also affecting currencies. One of the big issues that we've had over the past 6 months that are pegged to the US dollar. But, you know, just moving on, I think, you know, Saudi Arabia, are they going to decrease their oil production and lose market share to Iran? No. They're going to lower their production when their treasury reserves are dropping? No. I think not. You know, we still have some fundamental issues here. They haven't gone away in 3 days. So no, I think psychology is still going to be bearish, and I think fundamentals haven't changed. But, you know, as I've stated, the technical backdrop was there. It was there at the end of last week. And I see, you know, I reported to some of our staff on Wednesday some of the issues I saw in just a spike in volume leading up to Wednesday. And you typically see volume spike at turns, both bottoms and tops. Some momentum divergences. There was a lot of technical pieces here to the puzzle that were there. In fact, I think I was reading an email from Chris, my brother, that Dave Rosenberg sees deals in high yield and especially in energy. It was the first to turn down. It looks like it may be overdone and is predicting a recession, essentially, he says. And fundamentally, economically, do we see a recession? John, still no. But going back to the technicals, because that's really, I think, the main catalyst for this rally, I see heavy resistance above us. You know, former supports will act as resistance. There's some major areas that are going to be difficult to get through. And if I see any particular catalysts that jump up in the economics or central bank policy, any kind of fundamentals, if we get those over the next few weeks, I definitely will make sure that we discuss it here on the show. But no, I think the key catalyst for me right now would be possibly a pause from the Fed. and maybe some sort of language next week, which I would definitely tell our listeners to really focus in on next week on the meeting and look at what is discussed in the policy and in the media, because that will give you an idea very quickly if we're going to get that catalyst or not. But, you know, they risk losing face, and I don't think they want to do that. It's the Fed. And I think the biggest risk U.S. equity markets face in the near term is a Fed moving forward with its gradual glide path rates and, you know, to hell with fundamentals. And I don't think they can say that. I think I saw some numbers recently by the Atlanta Fed that, you know, growth estimates for the fourth quarter GDP were 2%. I think they're at 0.7%. They keep falling. But no, I think the main reason why they're doing it and why they moved forward with it anyways is they need rate ammunition, and they need it for the next shock and the next crisis. However, I think because of the restrictive policies we've seen from the Fed, removal of QE, the move towards raising interest rates, essentially they have been restrictive and they may themselves be creating the shock. There's no question.
You know, it's really true, because the thing that central banks have to do more than anything is manage what we would call expectations and image, because everything tends to move on that. And there have been so many critics that have been outspoken of the Fed, not to mention other central bank heads around the world, in sort of a, what are you doing this for?
The IMF last year, like around June.
Exactly. And remember the rate hike that we had in December after speculating it on it the entire year. I said we had to have a betting pool go as to whether or not this is going to happen. And Jim and I are going to talk about this in the big picture today. It's a principal part of our conversation, is what the expectation of the uncertainty, so to speak, that the Fed is doing here is causing in the markets. And Jim thinks they did this just to have ammunition. I call it wiggle room, because when they're at zero, if we get hit by another crisis within the next 48 months, similar to the one, say, back in 2008, they're out of ammo. You know, they're shooting on blank chambers, and they have nothing to try to stimulate the market with other than allowing the federal government to try to introduce measures that would change taxation policy to do that. And so this gives them a little breathing room, but it's only a little. And the statistics have been fairly clear, as you pointed out, that typically the markets do really well when the Fed raises. And I guess, you know, the question is it causality or correlation, or chicken and the egg? Which one came first with the recent rate hike? Good economics in the hike, or the hike hoping that we'll have good economics, or maybe both? You know, we had a little better economics and they hike, hoping that the economics get better and that it bootstraps its way up on the top.
It is comical when you look at it, isn't it?
It's got to be a better way to do this.
You know, we're flying by the seat of our pants there. But yeah, we are in new territory, and we haven't dealt with this kind of liquidity in the markets like 10 years ago. We've been adding it. The Central Bank of Europe has been adding liquidity. So there's been many that have been speaking out that we've been a big cause of a lot of events has been a withdrawal of liquidity, reserves, etc. But, you know, I think looking at the Fed futures for the March, you know, I think that's the big factor that we got to look at. You said expectations, and I think the Fed futures are expecting a 29% probability of a rate hike. And I'm hoping that rate isn't too far from the FOMC members' own thoughts. You know, we saw that in the dots last month, that there was a very big disconnect. The 2016 estimates didn't move a budge. So, you know, I'm hoping the Fed meeting next week will shed some light on that. And expectations, John, they can be a dangerous thing when they don't match reality. And the other risk I continue to worry about is an elevated dollar, just due to these diverging central bank policies. The strength in the dollar has hurt other currencies pegged to the dollar and their exports. We went through the same situation in the late 90s. So, you know, this also hurts the earnings of, like I said, the multinationals translating their assets and liabilities when consolidating financial statements. And, you know, like I said, those estimates have been lowered and now sit around $120 for the S&P. Stamp a 16 multiple on that, and like I said, what you get, 1920. So I'm just looking at a sheet here from FactSet on earnings, because it is earnings season. We are getting reports. So looking at the scorecard, just to give our listeners an update, about 15% of companies in the S&P have reported to date, and about 73% are reporting above earnings estimates, and about 49% are reporting sales above estimates. That's pretty decent and not a major shock there. But the one thing is that earnings growth continues to decline. we've seen for the fourth quarter a decline of around 6%. And if the index reports a decline in earnings for the fourth quarter, it will mark the first time the index has seen that. So that is, again, fundamentally the big issue here. Earnings, the dollar, oil. We're seeing oil rally. Let's see how long that lasts. So there's plenty of fundamental reasons for investors to stay a little wary here of this rally. But for the time being, a technical rally is here. Short and sharp rally would be typical of a bear market rally, while, you know, something slow and steady would point more towards, I think, a more important, possibly intermediate term low. The conditions are there for both, so I'll need more time to look at it technically, and I will report on that next week. But the levels I'm watching are 1950, 1966 is a target on a head and shoulder bottom, and then 1990 on the upside, as long as 1889 holds. That's my support I'm watching.
You know, I'm tired of all of this. I'm going to go get a Powerball ticket.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so we're going to be waiting to hear what the central banks say next week. And I'm assuming you're going to report on that. And we're opening a new pool, right? Because March is coming up. And in March, the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates, or won't they?
Ever at the center of our discussion.
Ever at the center of discussion. Anyway. All right, at least we have something to discuss. Ryan Poplava, have a good weekend.
You got it. You too.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Dr. Gary Small. He's professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at the Parlow Solomon Professor on Aging at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's also author of a new book called 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain. Doctor, over the last couple of years, you've seen a lot of software programs that have come out, cognitive training software, brain games. Let's talk about them. Are they really effective in arresting or enhancing the brain's functionality? I know there have been a number of tests, a number of claims made in advertising. I'd like to get your view on their effectiveness.
Some of the games are effective, and it depends how an individual uses them, whether they overuse them or underuse them, and what they're trying to train their brains to do. We did a study a number of years ago where we found that just searching online can activate our neural circuits. And it can be done very quickly. We can train an older person to search online for the first time, and we see increased activity in the frontal lobe. Now, whether that leads to improvement in everyday memory abilities, in thinking capacity, and other mental skills is not certain.
Probably not the best start to a new year. Just about everything is down, whether you're looking at global indices or you're looking at stocks here in the U.S. Joining us on the program is John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, let's begin with the S&P 500 on Wednesday. The markets broke below the lows that we saw back in, let's say, August and September. We're doing this interview on a Thursday when the market is in a rally mode. We've popped back up above those lows. So let me get your take here on what you're seeing in the major averages.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway in the major averages is that we are breaking 2009 uptrends all over the place. A month ago to clients, I was talking about breakdowns in three, what I felt, key cogs for the U.S. economy, basically proxies for those. Here's what I was looking at. I was looking at the PHLX Housing Index, HGX, broke its 09 trend line. I was looking at the SPDR Retail Sector ETF, XRT is the ticker. That broke down, and we had a target, a technical target of 40 in that particular index. We just hit that earlier this week. And then the third was in Norfolk Southern, which tracks very closely with the Dow Transportation Average. That was breaking down. So those three were telling me that there were some problems on the horizon. And then more recently, we've had breakdowns through 09 trend lines in the Dow Industrials, Transports, the Russell 2000, and then overseas in the Hang Seng out of China, in the Nikkei 225 out of Japan, in the CAC 40, FTSE 100, and DAX out of Europe. So this is not just a S&P 500 event or a one or two index event. I'm seeing this everywhere.
I guess the next question to follow up with that is, do you think we've entered into a bear market? I mean, if we take a look at, we sort of spent most of the year going sideways last year until we got to August and September. We got a nice rally back, but we never took out the previous highs. And of course, we have what's going on this year. Is this a bear market?
What I'm afraid of is that because of the weakness overseas, much of it, which actually preceded the weakness here, especially with the Hang Seng that broke down last July, I'm afraid that this is more than a correction, you know, and a quick move down to buy. There's been some technical damage here that speaks to a global slowdown showing up everywhere. You know, maybe a global recession. You know, you're seeing it in commodity prices are very depressed. So this is not a one-trick pony, or this doesn't look to me like, you know, the little pullbacks we had during QE all those years where it got to the 50-day moving average and then everybody bought it. This looks more serious, and the reason for that is because I'm seeing it all over the globe. And we're breaking major trends. Everyone has their own definition of what a bear market is. I mean, it's not really a standardized term as I know it. Some people say it's a bear market if you break the 200-day moving average, you know, depending on who you talk to. For me, I want to see a major trend that's been in effect for 5 years or more that has been broken, and it has been broken not just in one or two indexes, but it's been broken in many indexes. So by that definition, it looks like we may be going into that kind of a situation now.
You know, it's rather interesting because when you referred to bear markets, most major bear markets like we experienced in 2000, 2002, 2007, 2009 have always been associated with a recession. There have been exceptions. I think of the 14 bear markets, I think 10 were associated with recessions. This seems to be, John, in my opinion, something that is impacting the U.S. more so from things that are occurring overseas. Whether you're looking at Europe, when we went through that crisis, things aren't great there now. Now we have things going on in Asia, especially with China, and then also with the collapse in oil prices. So they seem to be more external events, but they're having an impact here.
I think that's a good observation. And, you know, 2 points to that. The first is that globalization has made the world a smaller place. Aside from that, there are intermarket correlations between the S&P 500 and a number of overseas indexes that have been in place for 20 years. So when I am trying to determine what's going on here, I look overseas. A lot of the day-to-day action that happens in our markets now seems to be driven by high-frequency trading, driving the S&P 500 up 30 the next day, down 40 the next day. It's, you know, the Wild West show, and I think people get really kind of hung up on that here. So I'm looking overseas. We keep a large database in here for 10 years of intermarket correlations. We update them every week, so we want to know what's correlated over 10, 5, 3, 2, and 1 year periods, and then over the last quarter to see what surrogates for the S&P 500 I can find overseas. And the DAX and the London FTSE very tight and stable with the S&P 500 for a long time. Not so much, but also the Hang Seng, and China has been positively correlated at various intervals. You know, the Nikkei 225 is another stable one. So, yeah, I mean, with all these major indexes being kind of tipped over overseas, that's one thing. The second point I wanted to talk about that nobody seems to be talking about is the yield curve. We just did a piece today on the twos tens curve. It's at 121 basis. It's edging underneath 121 basis points. It's actually narrowing underneath there. That's the difference between the yield and the 2-year and the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, of course. That got down to 116 yesterday on a closing basis. That's the lowest it's been in 8 years. A flattening yield curve indicates that the bond market, which tends to be much more forward-looking and actually more prescient, I think, than the stock market, is seeing economic weakness ahead, economic problems ahead. If we start trading underneath 121 on a sustained basis, 121 basis points in the twos, tens, that tells me that the smart guys in the bond market also see economic weakness ahead. So this, to me, is not just a global stock market event. You're seeing it in the bond market as well.
You know, you're bringing up an interesting point because credit spreads have just been blown out between what we're seeing in sovereigns, which have somewhat of a distortion to them given all the global QE that's going on. But what's going on in the junk bond market? And I guess the question is raised here. We spent all last year, John, talking about, will they or will they not raise interest rates? The Fed kept telling us they would, and they finally did it in December. Now, despite that, you have the World Bank, the IMF telling the Fed, please don't raise interest rates. Things are too precarious overseas, where we just referred to. And yet they went ahead. Now they're saying, you know, they're still going to go ahead and raise interest rates. You have to wonder, given what's happened with the Chinese currency, they spent $700 billion trying to defend the yuan, and it still hasn't worked that much. Saudi Arabia is doing the same thing, trying to defend their peg. So you've had almost $1 trillion of liquidity withdrawn from this market. You got to wonder what these guys are thinking when they look at all this stuff.
Yeah, regarding the Fed, I think they're an easy target for, you know, people to throw pies at. I think they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. I mean, if they would have raised last May, everyone says, you know what, if they would have raised a quarter point, you know, last May when the S&P 500 was making a new high, it would have been better, you know, than waiting until now. But again, you know, it's Monday morning. Quarterbacking of the Fed has turned into a cottage industry where people write newsletters and have jobs on television, you know, because of that. You know, that's just my little editorial on how I kind of see that situation. I mean, you know, they raised a quarter point. A quarter point, it's not going to make a huge difference in terms of the speed of the U.S. economy. What they did do, I'm afraid, to a certain degree, and you know what? You know, they could have done this in May and hindsight's 2020, but they're in a situation now where they're leaning towards further rate hikes. The thing that they don't want to do is take that 25 basis points back because that's going to really question their credibility. So, you know, they're in a very tough situation right now. But again, with only 25 basis point hike that really didn't make a meaningful difference in how the economy is going to run, you know, they can sit here for a long time and really effectively be where they were a year ago with a kind of a wink and a nod. You know, we think things are getting better now and eventually we're going to raise rates. And I don't know if that answered your question, but that's where I think they are.
I agree with you. Having spent the whole year telling us they were going to raise rates and they raise them a quarter of a point, to take that back, they'd lose a lot of credibility. But perhaps they just shut up.
Yeah.
You know, just keep the mouth shut. Just say we're watching data. We're data dependent, which the market would understand. I want to talk about another phenomenon that we've seen the markets trade on and get your take on that. And of course, that's the oil markets. The stock market seems to be tied or correlated on days that markets like oil on Wednesday got down to $26 a barrel. What's your take on oil here and the correlation that the market seems to be trading off it?
That's actually a great observation. And I actually did a piece on this on Monday, and it was picked up by Barron's yesterday. I don't have it in front of me. I tried to get a few things in front of me here. That's one of them that I don't have. But basically, the correlation has been in effect since the very end of last year. By correlation, I mean the positive correlation between spot WTI crude oil prices, closing basis, and the S&P 500. When I looked at this correlation, I looked back 10 years, 5 years, 3, 2, 1. You know, the correlation is relatively new. You know, people talk about it on television like, you know, it's been around forever and ever. Statistically, it has not. It's here now. What was troubling to me about that, and the reason that I wrote the piece, was that according to the long-term chart of spot WTI crude, when we broke support around $31, if my memory serves, the next major support level is $17 and change. That doesn't mean that we have to go there. It doesn't mean that that's a fair price for oil, but it means when you're looking at a fearful market that's being driven at least to a degree by fear, which is, it falls into the technically oriented realm, you know, people are looking for the next price level, and everyone has access to the same data we do here at Asbury. And it was a little bit troubling to me because with the next major support level being at $17 and change, and, you know, the news coming out of, you know, the oil industry and everything that's happening, and as long as that correlation stays intact with the S&P 500, which is a fear-driven correlation, it's not an economically driven correlation, it's a fear-driven one that started at the end of last year, it bodes towards a potentially deeper decline in the S&P. So that was my concern there. And again, you could look at Barron's. I think they picked it up the day before yesterday. If you search it on the website, you'll see it.
And John, let's move to another asset class, which seems to be getting a little bit of a lift here. It's questionable whether it stays or remains here, and that's gold.
Yeah, gold is one. Every week I go through about 35, 40 different commodities, some quite obscure ones, looking for opportunity. Because last year, you know, clients want to know where to put their money, and the stock market's going down. Interest rates were flat. The dollar was relatively flat, or it has been at least for the past few months. Global stock indexes, really, there's been no outperformers. We've been, you know, that old saying, you know, clean a shirt in a dirty hamper. So I've been really kind of beating the bushes for places where you can gain some alpha, gain some opportunity. And on December 22nd, I put out a piece to clients on gold. What was interesting to me was that the commercial hedgers, according to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, they publish COT data every Friday, telling you how these commercial hedgers are position in the futures market. They were at a least hedged extreme at the end of December, which means that they saw value area in gold around 1050 an ounce ish, if I recall my prices correctly. So the bottom line was they weren't hedging because they felt gold was either fairly priced or undervalued. So that tells me to start to look for bottom. The second thing that I saw were positive asset flows coming into GLD, which is the Spider Gold Trust ETF, that followed about 2 or 3 weeks later, a couple weeks later. So we've had clients long GLD for about a month. It's made money. I think it's risen by 3 or 4%, which in an environment where the S&P is getting hammered, it's been kind of a welcome addition to my clients' portfolios. We're watching those asset flows every day. It's still in a bear market, according to the 200-day moving average, and it's been there since February 2013. So over the near term, we're still cautiously positive on gold. We think it can take another run at that 200-day, which is up around 109 in GLD. But again, you know, I watch those asset flows every single morning, you know, when I hit my desk at 5 a.m. And when those flows change, if and when they do, we're going to be out with a small profit, and gold is probably heading back to the lows. But for right now, I'm cautiously optimistic that we can get up to 109.
So, John, given what you're seeing here, I've heard recommendations go all to cash. Where would you be deploying capital? Or would you just basically be sitting on the sidelines just watching and wait for this thing to clarify?
Well, the two places that we have recommended clients to be this month. I mentioned before in previous interviews, I built a model. It's a binary model. It's either in the S&P or out. It's called Correction Protection Model. You can see information on it if you go to our website. But the model went to cash on January 4th at S&P 2004. And at that point, we first suggested treasuries. Just for obvious reasons, we knew there would be an asset allocation out of stocks and into treasuries. It was kind of a no-brainer there, and that one has worked out well. I think that's a temporary trade that's going to work as long as the stock market stays under pressure. The other one has been in the utility sector, and this has been pretty recent. Over the past couple of weeks, we've suggested overweighting utilities. I built a metric that looks at asset flows in the sector spider ETFs and shows me which sectors that investor dollars are coming out of and which sectors it's going into. And it tends to lead price movement and relative performance. So we saw big flows into utilities 2 weeks ago, and last week it outperformed the spider by 4% in 1 week, which was a pretty nice move. That trade is going to continue to work as long as stocks are under pressure. Stocks are under pressure, it pushes money into treasuries. As treasuries goes up, it drives those nominal treasury yields down. And when those yields are down, when long-term interest rates are down from, you know, the treasury, when those yields are down, yield-seeking investors become a little more willing to take a little more, you know, credit risk, and that helps to push the utilities higher, take a little more credit risk to get a better yield. So that's the dynamic behind that. But those are the only two things that jump out at me right now.
Yeah, it's interesting your comment on bear markets, because the sort of definition, if it's down 20%, that's a bear market. Because I've gotten different views from all kinds of technicians on this program.
Yes,
yes, this is a bear market. No, this is a correction. And we're all looking at the same charts.
It's very squishy. I've never liked the 20% thing. Because what, if you're at 18.5, it's not a bear? I mean, to me, I want to look at a trend. Some trends are steep. Some trends are not so steep. So I want to look at a trend that's been in effect for what I would call a long-term period of time. And for me, that's a four-year presidential cycle. Just kind of ballparking it. You know what I mean? It might be 3.5 years. It might be 4.5 years. But I want to see a trend that has been in effect for a business cycle, a presidential cycle, something tangible that I can see in numerous assets. And if I can see it in assets overseas as well as assets here, that's even better. And that 09 trend was clearly the starting point. That was the end of the 08 bear market. That was the end of the financial crisis. And markets around the globe made substantial long-term bottoms, or let's call them at least cyclical bottoms, at the 09 lows. And there's trend lines that are based on that. So simple tool that comes from a common point of origination, and they're all breaking. So to me, that makes sense to me. How do you look at it?
I just look at the economics, and, you know, I'm more of a fundamental guy, and I have to alter some of my thinking because we follow a lot of LEIs, some of them proprietary. The U.S. economy is still going, but you have so many things that are going on overseas, especially with things in the dollar. You listen to corporate earnings, which I think have peaked. You've got rising wages now, and then you got a falling dollar, which is translating into, you know, lower profits. The question is, if this trend continues, how long will it be before corporations say, you know what, we got to protect margins, we're going to start cutting payroll? And that's sort of something I'm keeping my eye on, because that would be a sea change.
Interestingly enough, and you know this too, you often see it on the charts before the actual fundamentals come out, because those fundamentals are still formulating while money's moving. And that's what I'm afraid we might be seeing here.
Yeah, because, you know, if you're looking at this kind of stuff, you're a hedge fund or a macro trading fund, and you're seeing these fundamentals take place, you're taking action on that. And that's reflected in what you're seeing in the charts.
Absolutely, you are. And chances are that you know what's going on under the hood a lot more than, you know, mom and dad do. So, you know, the first sniff that there's a little blood in the water and these guys are starting to move money around, and I'm afraid that's what we're seeing. You know, the twos tens curve to me is really something nobody's talking about, and it's unrelated to stocks, but it's totally related to the economy and the economic projections, let's call them, of the bond market, which to me is much more forward-looking and much more accurate indication of what's going on than the stock market, which basically trades from economic release to economic release. So that's pretty compelling to me, and it's something I've been talking about for a while, and we've been sitting on that 121 basis points now for at least a month, maybe two. You know, the market sees it, and we're starting to roll through there. My feeling is once we break that, it could get to where we get a very sharp move in the yield curve over the course of a week or two, and that really could make this stock market decline kind of shift into a new gear. That's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah, see, we're watching credit spreads, and to me, it's signaling that there is some kind of credit event that's going to happen here.
Oh, yeah. I've been talking about those things actually since July is when, you know, I look at the B of A Merrill high yield corporate bond spread, which it actually jumped up 30 basis points overnight. It's 827 basis points from 788 on the 19th, a day earlier. Our work shows as long as that spread is widening, stocks aren't going higher. That spread starts coming in, and now we can support a rally. And that spread started to widen on December 8th.
I look at this, and I look at oil, and I think that somewhere, I just think a major credit event's going to happen. And that's going to shake the markets up.
So you're with me. You know, you're afraid of more downside here.
We're taking action. I mean, we've been going into bonds, raising cash, and we started that last November because we started seeing what was happening in the credit markets. And I don't know what it looked like to you. It felt like to us there was distribution that, you know, you'd get these rallies, but you just didn't see a lot of strength behind them.
Great observation. You could see it on the chart. That's that flat little rectangle we had from really Halloween on where, you know, we kind of went flat and that was a kind of like a big distribution top. And we had one for the first 6 months of the year. I started when a number of things happened, including corporate bond spreads widening in December. I was telling clients, don't necessarily get out here yet, but don't add. Don't add to portfolios. If clients are giving you money, if you have inflows here, save them, put them in a money market, do whatever you want to do with them. Don't put them in the market. And then when my model turned on January 4th, I made a round of calls to all my clients, every one of them. It took me days and just told them, you know, the model has turned. Whatever you do to play defense, you know, do that. Some people sell futures. Some people buy puts. Some people shift into various sectors that they like. Everyone plays it a little bit different, but fortunately, we've had a lot of thank you calls and we got a lot of people out of the way and they missed most of this. And it sounds like you did the same for your guys, which is great.
Yeah, I just take a look at this and whenever I see consensus, as I do, you know, one of the exercises I do is during the Christmas holidays, I gather all the forecasts, the consensus on the economy and the stock market. And you always notice, John, they're kind of like a bell-shaped curve. And I just say to myself, you know what? That's the bell-shaped curve. What end of the tail should I be focused on? And what I think is throwing people off, which is what you're picking up and what we're picking up, is typically you can say, well, the economy's not great, but it's still growing. So this can't be a bear market or a recession because that just doesn't happen. But I'm taking a look at events overseas and how we can say to ourselves, what's happening overseas is not going to impact us here. I'm seeing a lot of impact. I don't care if it's Saudi Arabia pumping oil. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal where Saudi Arabia is warring against Iran, negotiating with the Chinese for long-term contracts for market share in oil.
Yep, and they're racing each other to the bottom.
Yeah, so I mean, that can't be good.
Like I said, the world's a flatter place. If these countries overseas are taking it on the chin, that's going to affect corporate profits here, no?
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at the S&P and the Dow. What is it, 40-something percent of their sales come from overseas? So how can you have almost half your business tied to the global economy and it's not going to impact your earnings? I don't know. I don't buy that.
No, I don't either. And that's why I look at a lot of stuff and a lot of times it's not important and sometimes it's really important. Last year and into this year, it's been really important to know what's correlated to what and what's going on in different parts of the world. Because if all you're doing is focused on the U.S., you're missing a lot.
The other thing that we're paying attention to, this is something that you follow when you look at money flows. We're looking at global liquidity. I mean, the Chinese have spent $700 billion defending the yuan. The Saudis have spent $100 billion. There's been $1 trillion of liquidity taken out of the markets. Sovereign wealth funds are dumping.
You know what this reminds me of? And again, it's not really germane, but in a way it is. When I was a kid, I got into the business by getting a job in my very early 20s on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile back in the 80s. And kind of worked my way around the floor and, you know, got a little better job and got a little better job. I ended up in foreign currencies after being on the floor for a few years. And I was on the floor when Japan tried to defend its currency and when the British pound was being defended. And what I remember is that they could defend them for a day, a week, maybe a little bit longer, but ultimately the market forces and that multi-trillion dollar market would always win out and it would push that currency where it was headed before the intervention. So, you know, the intervention was like, you know, the little boy with his finger in the dike. Eventually the dam breaks. I don't think that's changed. You know, you could slow down, but, you know, nobody's bigger than the market. And I think, you know, that's the scary thing about this.
Well, let's just hope we can keep our heads above water in all this.
I mean, all clients want to allocate money, and I get that. You know, I get calls all the time, where do I go, where do I go, what do I do? But at the end of the day, if you can survive periods like this and stay in the game, that's how you do well over the long haul. And it sounds like we're both doing that for our people, which is good.
John, well, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Well, you could visit our website at asburyresearch.com, and there's a contact tab there. If you go to the contact tab, you know, fill out the basic information there and put in the little box that you heard the show from Financial Sense, we will send you a special offer. When we started the business 10 years ago, it was strictly institutions. We've recently put together a smaller package for individual investors, smaller investors, you know, smaller institutions. We will send you free samples of all the reports in that package and pricing information. And the other way that you can get that is by just sending an email to info@asburyresearch.com, and we'll get that out to you. You can take a look at it and see if you like it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Reva Balish. She's the Vice President of Global Analysis at Stratfor, a global intelligence and advisory firm located in Austin, Texas. And Reva, geopolitics have been really dominating the headlines, I would say, 2015 and into the start of the new year. I know that you just released your 2016 forecast. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about some of the major events and developments that you guys have on your radar for this year?
Well, where to start? As you said, you know, 2015 definitely had a lot of big geopolitical events that tend to scare the markets. And, you know, those were all events that fit into bigger trends that are still very much in motion. So for 2016, you know, I think the one clear point is you're not going to see much economic relief in the commodity markets. We're still looking at a prolonged period of low oil prices, which means a good deal of volatility in much of the world and major oil producing regions that we're looking at. It also means it has an opposite side effect in places like Europe and India, which, you know, is still doing quite well economically. You know, and China certainly benefits from those lower energy prices. So there's always two sides to that coin. But overall, the combination of lower oil prices, China's overall economic industrial decline and slowdown, these are all structural economic issues that are not going to see significant relief. And, you know, from there, we just have to look at what that means within each region, who's the most at risk, all while we're still going to see lots of activity within the Middle East. You have a very complex web of players there that are becoming a lot more assertive overall. And so, yeah, we can break it down from there, Chris.
Well, it's hard to believe 8 years ago the price of oil was at $150 a barrel. Now it looks like it's heading down to $20. a price that we haven't seen since 2003. Joining me on the program is David Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, let's begin with oil, because you read charts better than I do. But, you know, when you look at the price when we broke through 30, there doesn't seem to be any support for oil until you get to 20. And if you break through 20, the next support is 10. We've broken through 30. On the day you and I are speaking, we're at almost $26 a barrel. Looks like we're heading down there. What's your take here?
Very nervous, Jim. I don't want to overemphasize it, but I also want to be truthful. You know, you're a great host. You've always let everyone speak their mind. And so I've been anticipating, you know, being on the program, and I want to, as always, do my best to get the most insight that I can. So what I did was I went back and looked. This is from a friend of mine as well. That's in New Zealand, in fact. He works at a bullion company. And we were talking about this for some time. And this is the gold oil ratio. Jim, I want to look back in history and set the scene here because of why I am nervous at this sub-$30 oil. Any time where 1 ounce of gold bought more than 20 barrels of crude oil. So let me repeat that. Every time that 1 ounce of gold bought more than 20 barrels of crude oil, there was some type of crisis. So if we go back in the history, starting at World War II, roughly an ounce of gold by 30 barrels, that was World War II. If you go back, the next event was the gold Nixon shock, and we were around the $30 level. When you were about the 30 level, 30 meaning 1 ounce of gold bought 30 barrels of oil again, that's what that means. We had the 1987 stock market crash. It got above 25. We had the Latin American crisis, and then we had it at about 25 in the late 1990s. I should probably be giving the dates here. We had the Asian crisis. Then if you look at it touching 24, again, an ounce buys 24 barrels, we had the 2008 financial crisis. Jim, right now, as we speak, we're getting into a new territory. We're above 30. We're above that World War II point. Does that mean that there's going to be some kind of crisis? And the answer is, I don't know. What I do know is, you said I look at charts, I look at a lot of things, and I always look at fundamentals as well as technicals, and I always have, and I always will. This does make me nervous. Again, it doesn't necessarily mean anything, but let's face it, you and I are, I won't speak for you, I'll speak for myself, oil is absolutely the most critical commodity out there because it's energy, and everything revolves around energy. So that's it. I anticipated this, time will tell, but I'm nervous. I am nervous. I think that's the best statement I can make, so I'm sure you might want to give me some feedback on this.
Well, it's interesting, Dave, because as the price of oil, U.S. production went from 5 million to 9.6 million. The Saudis in November of 2014 said, hey, we're not going to cut. And of course, that started the decline that we're still in that trend. But it's interesting because at recent meetings, they've implied no further cuts. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about the war between Iran and Saudi Arabia fighting for a share of Chinese oil market. And of course, the Chinese are shrewd negotiators. So you have Iran coming online, and they're expected to increase their production significantly. And you've got Saudi Arabia, who's producing at maximum output right now. Both are driving for market share. So it's nobody seems to care what's happening to the price. What's interesting is this sell-off we're seeing in the market is being triggered by sovereign wealth funds divesting of money.
Exactly. I think everyone is nervous. I mean, you know, I'm presupposing that, but the markets certainly are indicating it. Looking at the global stock markets, you see downtrends pretty much across the board. The bond market isn't reflecting reality from my perspective totally, although the junk end, the sub, let's call it subprime in quotation marks. I'm sorry, I just watched the short twice now, so it's kind of fresh in my mind. But the junk bonds are certainly indicating that you know, things are getting less certain. But the equity market, of course, is nervous as well. So we're sort of at a point from the way I look at the chart and read sentiment that we could be, and I say could, not would, at a point where we could see a shift. And the shift would be, are equities the place to be, are they not? And, of course, the bond market, that's a very tenuous situation because myself and most of your guests that are similar in their thought process to mine have emphasized from the first time I was on your show that the debt markets are the real conundrum. It's the biggest market It's the most anticipated by those of us that understand finance and what debt really means, and that it's only been growing since the 2008 crisis. It hasn't been mitigated, really, in my view, in any way that's substantial. And yet the central banking authorities globally really have not done anything to mitigate the problem other than a lot of job boning and a lot of talking heads in the financial mainstream saying that everything is okay. Look at the unemployment numbers. Look at these things. But not true in my studied view. Things have not really ever recovered fully from the 2008 crisis.
No, and I mean, we've had fiscal stimulus and that kind of fizzled out, and basically it's been monetary stimulus that's been running the economy ever since then. And I know you've read it, I've read it, and everybody talks about the mistake that the Federal Reserve made in 1937 when the economy was recovering, markets were recovering, and all of a sudden they tightened prematurely. According to the Atlanta Fed, we've gone from the equivalent of a negative 3 percentage points, negative 3%, to almost zero. So there's been considerable tightening, Dave, in the bond market. You can see it in credit spreads. You can see it in credit default swaps, major spreads between, let's say, the corporate sector. You've got a crisis going in the junk bond market. And then you also have this rising dollar. All of this at a time that the Fed officials, and, you know, sometimes I think they just need to shut up, but they are persisting in tightening when the economy isn't growing at a rate that would be inflationary. We certainly don't see a lot of signs of inflation. So a lot of people have asked, why are they doing this? And the speculation was, according to Fed officials, well, we know there's another crisis down the road, so we're going to reload the chamber. But by reloading the chamber, they may be causing the very crisis they want to be prepared for.
Absolutely. I just could add on to that. I thought of this metaphor this morning, but, you know, you're quite an accomplished sailor. I'm not. I crewed for a guy for a year. I understand it somewhat. But it's as if, you know, getting into the natural order of things, and I believe the markets really are left alone, being the free market advocate that I am, that the recovery would be much better if there wasn't intervention by the Fed. It'd be like you sailing on the ocean and there's this big Queen Mary sized ship with these huge fans that are sending off this false wind so that you, let's say, have to tack longer than you normally would if it was left to the natural order. In other words, what the natural ocean currents and wind patterns would be. And so you're forced in a way to go along this tacking maneuver more than the natural order. And this is a metaphor I'm making because, as you said, and I agree with you totally, they really need to kind of step back and leave things alone. But they had the opportunity in 2008, and I'm not saying that that was the time to do it. I'm really pretty neutral on that because as much as I've looked at it, studied it, watched DVDs and documentaries and all of that, you know, if you had to ask me, and I'm going to state it, I think that they probably did what they probably needed to do. But I think once Paulson came in and did the $700 billion, that was probably it. And should have backed off from that point. But that's my, you know, viewpoint. I don't think that they could have let it go. I think it would have probably caused, you know, the collapse that some of us have talked about for a very long time. Regardless, the more they're fiddling with it, the worse it seems to become. And there's no, I almost want to say the word sanity as far as a longer term perspective and letting the markets do what markets do best, decide for themselves among these, you know, billion people voting with their pocketbooks on what direction the economic system should go.
Well, the interesting thing about all of this is this has been the first time that you haven't had monetary policy and fiscal policy working in conjunction. Normally, to be effective, the two work together. And I think in the next crisis, Dave, with interest rates at almost zero, and I don't think the Fed, personally, I don't think they're going to raise rates with all this going on right now. Yeah, I don't think they're going to lower it either because they look kind of silly and lose credibility. They spent a whole year telling us to raise it. They raise it a quarter point and the next meeting they lower it. I don't think so. But by the same token, I think in the next crisis with interest rates near zero, about the only thing left that they're going to have to do, you may see fiscal policy where government spends money. They just broke the budget deal. This year's budget deficit will be 3.5% of GDP instead of 2.5%. Maybe what you see next, and maybe this will be where gold really shines, is the government starts to increase deficit spending and the Fed just simply comes in and monetizes it, because I don't think the government can afford to see interest rates rise when you're approaching debt levels of $19
trillion. No, I totally agree with you, Jim. I think, you know, you might look back at the 30s and, you know, make work programs, and some were valid, I guess. I don't want to get too much in my political views. I want to stay on the monetary side if I can, or the economic side. But I think that is one thing that they really haven't tried. And as you said, you know, monetary and fiscal policy working together, and here we are, we're not. So I think that's a great insight for people to understand. And again, you know, nervousness, I mean, markets have a way of righting themselves eventually. It's certainly, you know, not much more needs to be said, I guess. I would like to move on a little bit more on the gold side, if I might. And looking at the indexes, I think it's the HUI, I might be wrong on it. One of the indexes broke downward through the 100 level, which it's held for quite some time. And if gold is a leading indicator and the equities in gold are a leading indicator to gold itself, physical gold, then what this could be showing us is that maybe we haven't seen the bottom in gold, although I believe that we have. But perhaps the way I interpret it is that the gold equities are sympathizing with the overall stock market. So the way I would interpret it at this point in time is that it's an indicator that the stock markets have not found a bottom yet, and that the gold equities are sympathetic, because let's face it, gold stocks are still stocks, and they generally move with the stock market, at least temporarily. And as things start to stabilize, gold stocks are usually the first to rebound to the upside. And of course, there are times I'm old enough to know that gold equities continue going up while the general equity market goes the other direction.
Yeah, because one of the things that we've seen is a rotation here as the market is headed lower along with oil prices. We have a divergence. Gold is finally over 1,100 on the day you and I are speaking. It's up $17. So it seems like the safety trade has been in the bond market with treasury yields falling below 2%, and also in the gold market with gold over 1,100. So that's been a little bit different than what we've seen in the past. Typically, it's been all into treasuries and not gold, but it looks like gold has got a little bit of a boost here.
Yes, and I probably overemphasize this, but you know, I'm a great adherent to the late John Exter's work on the inverted pyramid. And you know, going into the dollar, going into the bond market, going to safety, quote unquote, is something I've anticipated for a great length of time. And a lot of others are, well, how can the dollar be strong? Well, if you understand what the liquidity crisis looks like, then John Exter had it absolutely spot on, in my view. And that means that people will seek, you know, as you say, short-term instruments such as treasury bills or perhaps different places on the yield curve for safety. And all I would say, you know, 99% of the population thinks that that's the safest place you can be. It's only us, you know, crazies in the, you know, precious metals arena that look at gold as being the ultimate one, which is the way that John Exter looked at it. So what I'm trying to state, and I'll make it succinct, is that there'll be a huge run to the dollar before the run to gold starts. But as you pointed out, Jim, gold's starting to look like the safe haven trade in maybe a more casual or subtle way than most people realize. But I do believe and have thought of this, you know, since the first show that we did together, that there could be, and most likely would be, a point in time where the confidence level is broken and there will be a run to gold. Doesn't mean the end of the world, doesn't mean the end of the financial systems, doesn't really mean anything other than a run to gold. You see this huge input from basically most financial instruments going down the liquidity pyramid. You can look it up on Google, type in John Exter financial pyramid and you'll see it. And this is something that perhaps we're seeing a bit of a clue on it right now. You say 1100 isn't certainly a strong level for gold, but this idea that gold's going to trade under 1,000, I really don't think so.
You know, it could be interesting because I've thought about this, because there's speculation China devalued its currency in August 2 or 3%. And here's a key factor, which we're going to be talking about in the second hour of the show today, Dave, is in order to maintain the peg. Now, you're only talking about a 3% devaluation that they did in August. The Chinese have gone through $700 billion of currency reserves. I mean, that is a big number to maintain the peg. And there's speculation that rather than the market was thinking that they'll just gradually devalue the Chinese currency over time. Now there's speculation, and this got out from one of the officials in China, that they may just do it all at once. So maybe a 15% devaluation, and that could trigger a wave of devaluations throughout Asia. And I just wonder if that's what the gold market is trying to sniff out here.
Well said. I think you're right on. I really do. I mean, if you understand the derivative market, and you see how there's bets upon bets upon bets, and this was pretty well explained in The Big Short, that your foundation, what the derivative is based on, is very small relative to what all the side bets are. And so that means we're basically in an exponential function. So a little bit, you know, I understand this quite well. Others do also. I'm not trying to single myself out. But, you know, when you are in the futures market as long as I've been, and you're wrong or right, either way, but particularly when you're wrong, you learn really quick what leverage means. And the leverage in these, throughout the markets are so extreme relative to what they were when I started trading, you know, in my late 20s and early 30s. It's beyond comprehension almost. And so I want to give a real quick analogy if I can, you know, ghost gambling theory. And if you like, are on the roulette table and you bet nothing but black. If you bet, you know, $5 and you lose, then you bet 10 and you lose, and then you bet 20 and you lose, and then you bet 40 and you lose. So you keep doubling your bet. So you get this bet to rather length, you know, rather significant amount, but basically you're chasing a dollar bet, but now you've got $80 on the table. When you collect the 80, you've only won $5. And so this is an analogy to what's going on in these derivatives markets. You've got bet after bet after bet, and this is why, as you stated, you see these huge, massive movements on something that's a rather minuscule amount relative to what the underlying asset is, the yuan. So these things scare me, Jim, because I understand systemic risk. I understand that markets can get out of hand, and I understand the unpredictability of markets all the time. I understand a lot of these software programs and all that stuff. In fact, I beta tested one of the very early ones, but regardless of that, yes, you can predict human behavior some of the time, or maybe even most of the time. But as long-term capital management showed us, without any shadow of a doubt, you cannot predict it all the time. And that's what has me nervous.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts here. And I think what we're beginning to see is the ineffectiveness of, or at least the limitations of what monetary policy can do. Because, I mean, we're already down to 0% interest rates, and we used to see that in Japan for decades and never thought it would come here. But Dave, you know, it's been here for 8 years, and many think it'll be here for much, much longer. Listen, as we close, given what you see right now, what would you be doing?
Well, cash. You know, I've never been like anti-cash. I mean, being a precious metals guy and most of my life, certainly, you know, people overdo things sometimes. I mean, so many of people that have subscribed or not, but have gotten in touch with me one way or the other, is like, they understand the basic fundamentals of why you want precious metals, but they think like that's the only thing you should have. So rather than have a significant portion, like perhaps a 10% exposure or even 20, which I've advocated in the past, they go like all in. And you really don't want to be all in any market, but regardless, cash, I think, is a good place to be right now. And I think, you know, if you have your, let's say, hedge position in the metals, I don't think you necessarily have to add to it. If you're more aggressive and you understand where we are throughout the market, I would be adding. Certainly, I am cautiously adding in here into the underlying equities because they are so undervalued. I mean, gold equities are a better buy than gold itself by a long shot based on the math. But I think it's a good time to sometimes, this is going to sound corny, but I really mean it. Sometimes the best investment you ever make is the one that you don't make. And with that in mind, I think the best place to be is one of my favorite adages, trading. And it took me a while to learn it. And I had to learn it the hard way, but when in doubt, stay out. So don't make that trade. So I think the best place to be right now is to build cash. Don't get all excited about what the equity market's doing right now. Give it some time. See what happens. See if we get a bounce or if the fundamentals come to the fore and the market does better than what it's been doing since the beginning of the year. But I don't think it's a time to, unless you're very nimble or very experienced, I think it's a good time to be on the sidelines. So that's where I'm doing personally, and that's what I would be saying to people generally.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Great. I'm rebranding to the Morgan Report because we do so much more than just the silver market. So the new website, themorganreport.com. should be transferred by the 1st of February. So if you're interested in our work, please go there. Silver Investor will be up as a courtesy to everybody. And then started a new company, which is a streaming company, and that's being launched now. If you're interested in that, there's a website for that called LemuriaRoyalties.com. You can type in Lemuria Royalties into Google. It'll bring you to our landing page, and you can get the term sheet and take a look. It's private right now. I'm not recommending it. I'm just making note that we've been asked for years about, you know, getting a gold-silver position that's, let's say, at a discount, which, of course, you can do with a streaming company. So this is what we are doing at this point in time, and we already have about three companies lined up that we are very, very well acquainted with due to my years in the industry that look like they'll be favorable of doing deals with us.
Well, when it comes to the Federal Reserve and its policies, it almost seems like we're in the same game we were in last year. Will they or will they not raise interest rates again? And maybe more importantly, given the level of uncertainty that we have seen in the markets so far this year, which started off with a bang, right, with the first week of the new year, are they making a major policy mistake that could flip us down into a recession? We have to examine that because they're still pushing the we're going to raise interest rates line again, and that will affect how things go. And of course, the other important question is, how should investors behave in this kind of a market where everything's quite choppy? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.